Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for June is called Christian Ethics in the Workplace. I'll tell you a little bit about that in just a few minutes. We have one of its co-authors on the line with us for about 25 minutes here. We're going to be talking about making Christian ethics a reality in the workplace. Now, this is difficult. Any of you, I don't work in business. I work in radio, okay? So it's a dirty business in and of itself, but for very different reasons, having very little to do with money. However, most of you probably view the business world as a little bit dirty. You can't go in there without getting a little dirt under your fingernails. And I'm talking about ethical dirt, because it's a place where compromise is often called for. It's a place where you're told, you know, you're going to do what's good for business rather than do what you think is right. Leave your ethics at the door if they conflict with where we're headed and the bottom line. It's a difficult place to remain ethical. Are there certain ways that in the business world you can put policies and practices into place so that ethics are actually encouraged and so that people can understand that good ethics sometimes make for very good business? We'll be talking about that for the first half of this hour of Issues Etc. In the second half, Dr. Leon Pottles, author of the book The Church Impotent, The Feminization of Christianity, will be joining us to talk about the importance of fathers to church going. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Jim Truesdell is our guest for the first 25 minutes. He's co-author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. He's president of the Brower Supply Company, based here in St. Louis, and president of the North American Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Wholesalers Association. Jim, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you, Todd. It's great to be back.
Jim, have I painted too dim a picture of the average, at least the attitude in the average workplace toward business and workplace ethics?
Well, I think you've painted a picture of, I'll say, the popular perception of how things are in the workplace, and unfortunately in too many workplaces maybe they really are. Our free enterprise system certainly is oriented towards making a profit, and that certainly is legitimate, and many good things come to our society from business profits. However, it's how those profits are obtained sometimes that impact upon our spiritual life and the ethical choices that we make. Are we doing things just for pure self-interest, just to put another dollar in our pocket, or do we combine this also with a concern for the common good, for truly serving our customers, serving our coworkers? In other words, are we focused obsessively on making that additional dollar to the exclusion of all else? Are we able to turn the profit motive as a complement to doing good for our fellow man?
You know, we have laws in place, and we've seen them on display with rather in some rather remarkable ways in the last week. Martha Stewart was indicted for insider trading. One might argue had Martha had her stockholders and her customers' interests in mind, as you said, serving them, she would not have engaged in the things she's alleged to have engaged in insider trading. Is that the basic point here?
Well, certainly we don't want to necessarily judge her or any individual, but I think it is true we have to keep in mind that we are serving a broader constituency than just ourselves. If we focus on the common good, if as leaders of a business we focus on servant leadership of the people whose business lives we are steward of, if we understand that we have a responsibility to the customers whom we serve, then I think we will be complying with the spirit of the law, not just the letter of the law. And we see these high-profile cases, and people are being indicted and brought up because they allegedly have violated the letter of the law. But I believe the Christian needs to go beyond that, needs to look at the spirit of the law. What truly is the right thing to do? Just not doing what the law says we must do. I think we're called upon to go a step further to do the right thing.
How would you respond to the person who says, look, I do understand that we ought to have a high regard for ethics in the workplace, but my competitor does not have that same high regard, and in order to compete on level ground with my competitor, I might have to occasionally compromise. How would you respond?
Well, I think if he says I might have to occasionally compromise, I would say that both from a worldly standpoint and from the long-term perspective of what is in the interest of your business, what is in the interest of you as a person, you need to to forgo that occasional compromise. Think about the businesses whom people truly regard highly, the businesses that stand the long-term test. They generally are businesses who have a reputation for acting ethically, for making the long-term decisions rather than the short-term decisions just to get that order. You can think of some pharmaceutical companies who took some long-term decisions when they had some products that were adulterated in the manufacturing process, and when they got out into the marketplace, those companies made the decision to pull them immediately off the shelf, take the short-term hit to profits. And in the long term, they've gained the consumer's confidence. On the other hand, you can think of some companies, maybe in the automotive area, where there were problems developed, and the decision they made was the best short-term decision, thinking, well, all right, well, maybe the problem is not as big as we think it is. Maybe we'll just handle it on a case-by-case basis, and maybe it'll go away. Those companies have suffered harm to their reputation. So I would say, even if you're looking at things from a worldly perspective, if you make the ethical choice and you do the right thing, it's probably going to inure to your benefit. Ethics is good business, but of course we need to remember that we don't make ethical choices because ethics is good business. That's, again, looking for our selfish interest. We do the right thing because God has commanded us to do that, because we're using the gifts he's given us to our fullest in the workplace, and certainly as Christians we want to let our light shine as an example to others.
You write about building an ethical culture within the workplace environment. What do you mean by an ethical culture?
Well, you know, let's consider a story in the Song of Solomon. It talks about a farmer that had a grape vineyard, and he had a problem with foxes that got into the vineyard and began to eat the grapes in the vineyard. And this was a problem, but the biggest problem he had was the little foxes, the small foxes that couldn't reach the grapes, but nibbled at the vines. And over a period of time, it began to kill the plants. Well, that's the problem sometimes with the workplace culture. It's not the big decisions made at the top or a great big high-profile decision, but it's the little things that people, both managers and employees, do over a period of time that begin to nibble at the vines, set a workplace culture that eventually will destroy the business and the relationships of the people involved in it. As Christians, it's incumbent upon us to do what we can to contribute to a positive, ethical, and righteous culture in our workplace. That means even if somebody at the top or a manager is pointing the company in the wrong direction, that we need to be able to raise questions at the proper time in a tactful way, like, you know, hey, is this really what we stand for? Is this really the way we want to be representing these products to our customers? And then other Christian people within that context need to support whoever has the courage to speak up and say, well, you know, that troubles me too. In tactful but consistent little ways, we can all begin to change that workplace culture and point it in the positive direction. Whether we're at the top of the power chain in the company or whether we're a line worker, we all can contribute to establishing the right kind of culture at our workplace.
Who bears ultimate responsibility? I mean, speaking as a businessman and actually the president of a business yourself, who bears ultimate responsibility for not only creating but fostering that ethical culture at the workplace?
If we are a manager of a business, if we are on the board of directors of a business, if we are at the top of that command chain, then we have a special responsibility. We are stewards of the assets of that business. We are stewards of the work lives of the people that work there. And we have a special responsibility to point that enterprise in the right direction. This is especially so if we profess to be Christians and people of faith, because, in effect, we represent our Lord if we're stating that, I'm a Christian and I believe this, and then my actions don't demonstrate that. If my actions point in another direction, sometimes people will judge the church and people of faith by those actions. So the first responsibility is with the people at the top. But this should not be used as an excuse by other people within the company to look the other way and say, well, I'm only following orders. I can't do anything about it. We can all do something to contribute to the climate within a business. And some of the ways I've talked about, these tactful raising of questions, the supporting of people who do make the right kind of decisions, we cannot just wash our hands of it and say, well, I'm sorry, I work here, the president says to do this, and that's the way it is. We gradually and slowly can begin to affect those cultures. You know, most people want to think of themselves as ethical and honest people. And if they're brought up short with a question about their behavior, most people will think about what they're doing and possibly change their ways. I mean, who wants to be thought of as a crook or a dishonest person? When people are confronted with it, most of the time, they'll step back and do the right thing.
You suggest a comparison in one of the chapters you've written in the book, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, between building this kind of culture of ethics, a means by which to do it, and what was very popular in Japan and even in some American firms too recently, called total quality management. Tell us about that program and how it compares, or how it can inform us about building an ethical culture in the workplace.
Well, let's first look at the Bible. In Colossians 3:23, it says, "Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord, not men." Then Ecclesiastes 9:10, "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might." Scripture tells us clearly that we're to give our best effort to whatever we're engaged in. God has placed us where we are, and our duty is to give it our best effort. In the last 10 or 15 years, we've adopted in many of our businesses these principles of total quality management. Edwards Deming, the fellow who went over to Japan, developed much of the theories underlying that. And we've taken a lot further in the last decade with a lot of statistical process control and ways of measuring our success. But high standards are expected of us. God has given us our gifts, whatever talents we have. And just like a fine athlete who competes because he's been given gifts and wants to use them to the fullest, we use our gifts to the fullest, and we provide a quality product, quality service, as a means of praising God with the gifts that we've been given.
So I could liken this to the idea which is drawn directly from Scripture, that of Christian vocation, that God has put us in this place and endowed us with the gifts he's given us, so that we might serve our neighbor and do it to the best of our ability. Obviously, everything we do is tainted with sin, but we strive to serve our neighbor as well as we can, because God hasn't given us these gifts. He's provided us with the mercy of Jesus Christ that motivates all of this service to neighbor. It sounds like a very close companion to that doctrine of vocation.
Sure, and you know, Martin Luther in his day talked a lot about the doctrine of vocation. Prior to that time, people tended to see it during medieval times. People tended to see things in terms of, well, the monks in the monastery and the priests. They would live the holy lives, and everybody else was stuck in the muck and the mire of the world. But Luther called our attention to the fact that we can all serve God wherever we are, and if we're placed in the lowest of vocations, if we're just cleaning up something or doing something very lowly, we still can do that and glorify God by doing our very finest in that situation.
There is another dodge to the ethical questions of the workplace, and it has to do with what is legal. We hear it a lot. If it's not illegal, then we're not going to worry about it. We're not so concerned about what's ethical. We're simply concerned, because we're a business, about what's legal. How do you respond?
Well, certainly I think you can make a lot of decisions within a workplace that can be legal, but still, one, are not the right thing to do, and two, can get us in a lot of difficulty. We talked with my co-author in this, Ray Hilgert, and he sets forth a series of tests that can be applied to some of the actions that we take in business. And the very first and minimal test is that legal test. Certainly there are lots of lawyers and law firms that exist defining for people how they can step up to the edge of legality without going over it. But that doesn't mean that we're complying with the spirit of the law. If you look at some of Mr. Hilgert's tests, one that he suggests is the public knowledge test. What if the business decision you're going to make today is going to be broadcast to everybody on KFUO tomorrow? Would you still do the same thing? What if you had to go home and explain it to your children or to your pastor? Would you still do the same thing? And you can follow this right on up a continuum, testing whether your business decisions are made looking at long-term consequences or just for short-term gain, on up to the question of the voice of conscience here. If some little voice inside of you says that what you're about to do is wrong, then it probably is, and you need to re-examine what you're doing. The test for a Christian, of course, that little voice, that voice of conscience, has it been developed to reflect the will of God through through years of studying the Bible, associating with Christians, going to church, dealing with good Christian role models, so that when you hear that little voice inside of you, it's not the voice of self-interest. It's truly the voice of conscience reflecting what God would have us do in our life.
You talk about the profit motive, and I believe that Americans are generally comfortable with the profit motive, but where are the pitfalls in this? As a businessman, where have you found the pitfalls in what would otherwise be a pretty decent thing, the profit motive?
Well, certainly the profit motive underlies our free enterprise system, and a lot of very good and positive things come from that. Certainly many of our social services, our churches, all exist because we have businesses that turn a profit. The problem is people let this search for the profit become an obsession in their lives. When it begins to take over a person, when they forget what those profits are generated for, when they see it as a means of self-aggrandizement and not as producing profits to provide jobs, to meet societal needs, that's when we get into problems. I remember, and when we cite in the book, one of my favorite stories, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, in a situation where Scrooge was confronted with the ghost of his partner, Jacob Marley. Ebenezer Scrooge turns to him and says, "You were always a good man of business, Jacob." And the ghost of Jacob Marley shouts back at him, "Mankind was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business." We have to remember that what profits are for, they're here to make a better life for everybody, that we can serve others through that. And as long as we keep it in mind what it's for, not just a scorecard where we feel good by triumphing over everybody else and piling up a pile of dollars, then I think we're on the right track.
You also write about Powell Woods, who's a Lutheran pastor who in his first career rose through the ranks to become the vice president of human resources and community relations at Nestle USA. Explain what he means by this. He says, and you quote him, "The primary moral obligation of any management team," and he's talking about someone who leads a business, "is to focus on the employees of the organization, is to focus the employees of the organization upon quality and to assist them in every possible way to carry out the quality mission." What does he mean?
Well, I think this goes back to the concept of doing our God-given duty to do our very best to serve the people for whom we produce products. Powell is he's a Lutheran pastor up at a Missouri Synod, Lutheran Missouri Synod Church up near Cleveland. And he gave an example. Back when he was working with Nestle, Stauffer Foods, one of their subsidiary companies, had a factory where they were making some macaroni and those kind of goods. And they came across one particular batch just which wasn't quite up to standards. And they called all the employees together around a big kettle and talked about this particular batch not meeting their standards. And they made a point of pouring it all out right there and starting over again as a means of stressing to the employees their collective duty, all of them, to produce a quality product for their customers. God gives us our gifts. He expects us to do our very best to serve others with it. And this ties into the whole TQM process we talked about, which can be synonymous with our duty as Christian workers and Christian managers.
How should a Christian employee understand himself in relationship to his employer, especially when it comes to ethics? Where does it begin? How does he understand himself as an employee?
Well, as an employee, we certainly have a duty to give a fair day's work for the wages that we receive. When you enter into an employment relationship, you're entering into an implicit contract that you're not going to speak ill of that employer, that you're going to be a good steward of the business's assets, that you're going to protect the proprietary secrets of that business, and you'll give it your best efforts. And even if we don't necessarily agree with everything our employer believes, we can't necessarily substitute our own judgment for that. However, that does not relieve that employer of the obligation to also be a steward of the work lives of his employees, to not put them into compromising positions. And as a result, we need to remember that the employer is purchasing the labor of the employee. He's not purchasing the laborer. And therefore, employers need to remember that the employees are not just removable pieces in a puzzle or cogs in a wheel. They are living, breathing people, and they are children of God, just as is the manager. So both parties need to understand they have reciprocal relationships to each other, and both have a duty to lead the other in the direction of God's will.
We've heard the old adage, and I'm sure that this is repeated many times in the business world, the customer is always right. Is that always true?
The customer is always entitled to respect and probably, indeed, the benefit of the doubt. In almost all instances, we're going to do what we can to meet the customer's needs or to find an alternative way to meet the customer's needs. But there are some instances where a customer might be pressuring us to step over an ethical line, let's say falsifying invoices or bribing us as a person selling it to them where they want us to put a little more in the package or whatever. And at those points, we have to remember that the customer is also subject to those ethical guidelines, and we need to tactfully draw a line over which we cannot cross. And hopefully, we'll still retain that customer's business because he or she will respect us for so doing. This is interesting. These are some of the kind of problems we're running into. I've recently become affiliated with St. Louis University's Emerson Center for Business Ethics, and these are very similar to some of the cases that we've been discussing there with some of the students in the groups at St. Louis University, where you have these conflicting duties and the responsibility we all have to still be consistent with our Christian values.
Jim Truesdell, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Well, thank you very much, Todd. Great to be here.
Jim Truesdell is president of Brower Supply Company here in St. Louis, president of the North American Heating and Refrigeration and Air Conditioning Wholesalers Association, and he is one of the co-authors of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June called Christian Ethics in the Workplace. It would make a great Father's Day gift. You can purchase this book online tonight at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on Christian ethics in the workplace. You can also order it by calling Concordia Publishing House tomorrow at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. If you would like this as a Father's Day gift, visit Concordia Christian Books and Gifts at either their locations. If you order it via the telephone or the website, it's just too short a time to get the book, but you can go to either of the Concordia Christian Books and Gifts locations, either here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, or at 3558 South Jefferson here in St. Louis, the main store. The book is called Christian Ethics in the Workplace. That address again for the main store, 3558 South Jefferson here in St. Louis. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. When we come back from this break, we'll be spending the remainder of this hour talking with Dr. Leon Pottles. Why do we find fewer men in church? When did this begin? And why does the church suffer from a lack of fathers? That's the subject for the last 25 minutes of the program. You may have noticed fewer men in church, and it seems as though there are more women than ever. We'll find out why when we come back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Perhaps you've heard someone say, right and wrong are all fine and good, but this is business. Is the place of business any place for Christian ethics? How does the Christian square the profit motive, the bottom line, and business competition with Christian ethics? In our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, its authors explore these very questions and through case studies show how Christian ethics work in the workplace. You can receive your copy by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. The book costs $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Or order online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book. When you call or write, be sure to ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, 1-800-325-3040.
Dinosaurs in the Garden of Eden?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the intriguing book on dinosaurs, The Great Dinosaur Mystery Solved. Well, Ken, do you think dinosaurs were roaming about in the Garden of Eden?
Well, I certainly do. Even though I was ridiculed on a national public television program in America for believing it, I firmly believed Tyrannosaurus and Stegosaurus and all the other kinds of dinosaurs lived happily alongside of Adam and Eve. You see, the Bible teaches there was no death and bloodshed, disease or suffering before Adam sinned. So there couldn't have been any dinosaurs dying out before Adam fell. Not only this, but God tells us that he made all the kinds of land animals on day six. Now, this is the same day he made the first man and woman. So starting with the Bible, it's logical to say that dinosaurs lived with Adam and Eve. Now, how could Adam and Eve have coped with these great creatures? Well, actually, before sin, all the animals were vegetarian, as Genesis teaches in Genesis chapter 1, verse 30. And there was no violence or anything like that. It was a perfect world. So Adam and Eve didn't have to fear dinosaurs. But sadly, because of the influence of evolution, many Christians don't know what to tell their children about dinosaurs. But starting with Genesis, they can learn lots of things about these fascinating creatures that real science confirms.
Ken Ham has many more insights to share with you regarding dinosaurs. The information's available free if you log on to our radio website, AnswersRadio.com. That's AnswersRadio.com.
Leon Pottles is the guest for the remaining 25 minutes of Issues Etc. this afternoon. AM 850 KFUO weather for St. Louis. Overnight cloudy. Thunderstorms are likely once again and a low near 64. For tomorrow, mostly cloudy. A continued chance for rain and a high near 83. Right now in St. Louis, overcast and 75. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Southbound 170 between Brentwood Boulevard and 40, slow traffic in the right lane. Northbound 270 at Dorset Road, slow traffic in the right lanes to the 70 exits. Eastbound 270 between Lindbergh and 170, slow traffic there. Eastbound 40 between the Woods Mill Road and Mason, slow traffic. Northbound 55 between 44 and the Poplar Street Bridge, some slow traffic there. And eastbound 40 between Jefferson and the Poplar Street Bridge, some heavy traffic.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Wallace. Does your husband or boyfriend make you feel like chopped liver? Does he make you feel like apologizing for being a human being? Do you know this could be a sign of emotional abuse? Exchange the open wounds of emotional abuse for healing from the scars of emotional abuse when you meet Dr. Gregory Jance next time on Woman to Woman.
Saturday mornings at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll be talking with Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois about the ban on partial birth abortion passed by the House last week. It sits in conference committee and goes to the president's desk and will face judicial challenge. We'll get all of that with John Shimkus tomorrow on Issues Etc. We'll also talk with Chris Armstrong of Christian History Magazine about J.R.R. Tolkien. They have actually devoted an entire issue to the man, J.R.R. Tolkien, and we'll round out tomorrow's show with a conversation with James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries about the election of an openly gay Episcopal bishop. He is saying, by the way, this bishop has said recently in the press, that God is doing a new thing. God is now doing a new thing. We'll see what James White has to say tomorrow on Issues Etc. We'll spend the last 25 minutes of the program talking with Dr. Leon Pottles. He's senior editor of Touchstone Magazine, a regular guest here on Issues Etc., and author of the book, The Church Impotent, The Feminization of Christianity. Dr. Pottles, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
What does research show with regard to men and church attendance?
Well, basically, men don't go to church in the same proportion as women. It varies from denomination to denomination, but in all Western churches, women are the majority in the congregations, and in some churches, women are as high as 80% of the congregations.
What impact does this have on the children of these men who do not attend church?
Well, basically, they don't. There was, I think, a Swiss study recently. Switzerland has the advantage of having official government reporting religion as the census asks detailed questions about religion. And they've, as I remember the data, the the most important factor of whether the children will be Christian is whether the father was an active Christian. That the mother's church attendance doesn't seem to be that important. The key factor is whether or not the father goes to church. If he doesn't go to church, the children will almost certainly not be Christian.
So we're looking at a trend that has the capacity to compound itself, especially if the children are also male, and they grow up to be the fathers who don't go to church, right?
Well, that in fact has happened. There are many generations of of males who have not gone to church in their families. That the boys see their fathers not going to church, they see the mothers going to church. They figure this is for women, not for men. But even the girls are much more likely to be active Christians if their fathers have been active in the church.
Can we discern the rationale here among the men who are not attending church, why they feel no need or do not desire to attend church, generally speaking?
I think we've been over this before, but I'll go over it again, men feel the church is for women, and there are historical reasons for this that go back centuries, but basically the church has become the sphere of women. That is, it's a proper sphere of women. Men are generally happy that women are involved in the church, but they figure that's a woman's business. A man's business is something else. That for men, being involved in the church shows he's weak, that he's not a real man. Real men don't need the church, and that women need the church. It's good for women, but it's not really for men.
You said this goes back centuries. In fact, I think you can actually date the feminization of the Western Church rather exactly. Tell us about that.
Well, suddenly, in about shortly after the lives of during the lives of Saint Dominic and Saint Francis, and I think of the 12th century, that we began getting remarks that women are not going to church, and that men are not going to church, and that women are overwhelming the churches. That St. Francis, in his lifetime, was very concerned that only people coming to his disciples, the Franciscans, were women. St. Dominic forbade his followers, which was ignored, to be the spiritual counselors of women. He wanted them to preach to men, but very quickly, almost all the audience was women. And preachers in general began making remarks that the people came to hear sermons, who went to services, things like that, were almost all women. And this began rather suddenly in about the 12th, 13th century.
Did this not only, you know, that the Dominicans began to focus upon women almost exclusively after this trend began, did it signal a theological change in the church as well as simply a demographic change?
Well, I think it both was a result of a theological change and sort of fed that change. That several things were going on. The most important one was that church thought, following Aristotle, thought that women were receptive by nature and obedient, and therefore they made better Christians than men did, which is sort of hard to explain why Christ became a man then rather than a woman. But this was, Aristotle said that women are, the female in general, and women are more receptive than men and more obedient and more docile than men. They learn better. And that therefore they make Christians thought that they made better Christians because they could be more obedient to God. They found it easier to be obedient to God, while men found it harder to be obedient to God. Now this is not true, but this is following Aristotle's analysis, and that said, and so when the church became predominantly female, that is, almost the congregations became 70-80% female, and the people most interested in Christianity were almost all women, that this led to theological changes, because men and women are different. They have different attitudes to life, fundamental attitudes to life, and that the female attitudes began dominating the church. One of them being, and it's a good attitude, that women are very reluctant to break relationships. They keep the family together. They're the ones who try to settle feuds. They don't like war. You know, this is a good attitude. But applied to the church, this meant that women were more and more reluctant to take stands. They tended toward the belief that everybody was going to be saved. And nowadays, centuries later, that in fact, the religion you have is not that important. You know, it's whether you can be saved, whether you're a Buddhist or a Muslim or Christian, because God wants everybody to be saved, because women can't endure the thought that relationships might be forever broken. So this had significant theological impact on the church.
Does that explain why you note early in a paper in an article in Touchstone, Missing Fathers of the Church, you note early that the more liberal the denomination in its theology, the higher percentage of females attending?
That in general is true. That the and I think the key is that these liberal denominations have totally given up on church discipline. That is, they will not maintain church discipline in either behavior or doctrine. They'll accept almost any behavior and almost any doctrine, except traditional ones in some cases. And for instance, the Episcopal Church is now ordaining a gay man who left his wife and children and divorced them so he could live with a gay lover, and they're ordaining him as a bishop in New Hampshire. This is, of course, unimaginable, but they can't bring themselves to say this is wrong, because it would mean breaking a relationship, and they're so reluctant to break relationships that they accept almost any behavior.
Now, this, just as a sidebar here, we're talking primarily about Western Christianity. Is there really a difference if we looked at the Eastern Church, the Orthodox tradition? Would we see a difference there? Because they have been in some ways theologically and culturally isolated from some of the factors you talk about here. Would you see a difference?
Now, there is a difference. Now, for the communists, for many years, communism is a Western ideology. It's not an Eastern ideology. And the communists thought that religion was for women, and they tolerated religion for old women because they had this Western ideology. They thought, well, if we have to have religion at all, if old women go to it, that's okay, because religion is for wimps. Religion is for women. Men should not go to, and the young should not be involved in the church. So the communists imposed this behavior on the East, but I'm told that before the communists came, that orthodoxy was a very vigorous masculine religion. And the musical tradition shows this, because their musical tradition is for male voices, not for female voices. That their choirs were exclusively male for many centuries. And this is an indication that it was the men who considered themselves as being very important to the church, not the women.
You note also that you were surprised to find not only a feminist agenda at work sometimes behind the feminization of the church, but there were those alongside from a traditional line of argumentation. You've mentioned this already a bit here, but I'd like you to expound on the strange nexus between feminist arguments and traditionalist arguments.
Well, this tradition, which is not really the ancient tradition of the church, it's something that goes back to the Middle Ages, is that women make better Christians than men because they're more docile, they're more obedient, they're more subservient, and that therefore they're better Christians. And that therefore, with the ideal church is an all-male clergy, and almost all female laity, because the women are obedient, they will listen to this male laity and male clergy and be obedient to them. And this is sort of, I use traditional in quotation marks, it's not really the true tradition of the church, but this is a deformed tradition which has grown up in the church. And that the feminists have sort of accepted this, except they say women should not be subservient to men. They should be, if they have to be obedient and subservient, they should be subservient to other women. So the clergy should be female, because the congregations are predominantly female. So the clergy should look like the congregation. So we don't have a male-female obedience. That women, they admit obedience is a good thing, but should be to other women, not to men.
You have written a little bit of prognostication here, Dr. Pottles. In the mainline churches, the seminaries have a female majority, and shortly the ministry will be a female occupation. One will have to say male minister as one now has to say male nurse. Think it really will come to that?
I think it's already coming, because I think the New York Times, after I wrote my article, had a similar article that the clergy are becoming so feminized that almost all the new clergy are female. And there are also reasons for this. Decline in the prestige of the mainline churches means that their ministers are not being paid very much, so men have the additional problem if they're how to support their families. You know, if you become a minister in a lot of mainline churches, there's not enough money to pay you. Often the churches are shrunk, the jobs are part-time, and women are taking these jobs for economic reasons, because they're often married, their job is a part-time job, it's not really the main support of the family. They can afford to be ministers, men can't afford to be ministers in these churches.
We're talking about the importance of fathers to church going and the feminization of the church. Dr. Leon Pottles is our guest. He's senior editor for Touchstone Magazine and author of the book The Church Impotent, The Feminization of Christianity. One must ask then, if men are staying away from the church, where are they seeking for lack of a better term, religious fulfillment.
Well, in the 19th century, in the first part of the 20th century, they sought it in the United States in fraternal orders. The Masons were extremely important in the United States. The Odd Fellows, the Knights of Pythias, all these fraternal orders left behind a vast heritage of big buildings in almost every town and city and village in the United States, because they were the male version of the church. Men went to the lodge, the women went to church. And these fraternal orders often presented men with the realities of life and death. They had ceremonies in which you had to confront death, often a skeleton or something like that. And it was all done in a ritual way, but it was meant to make men realize, you know, we're mortals. We have a limited lifespan. We have to fulfill responsibilities in the few years that are given to us. And these this seriousness of life was transmitted by the lodges. Now in Europe, unfortunately, the churches were replaced by ideologies, by Nazism and fascism and communism. These were often consciously male religions that these were designed to confront men with the reality of life, to make men protectors of their society in a very distorted way, but they were consciously male societies, and women played very little role in them.
Now, jumping forward into the future, or into our time, very recently there has been a very popular attempt to bring men back to the church. It was called Promise Keepers. You're aware of this. What was the shortcoming of this organization?
Two shortcomings: that the devotion, the piety, the religious attitudes they preached were often derived from the feminized Christianity. They would talk to men about falling in love with Jesus. Now, it's one thing to establish a friendship with Jesus. It's another thing to fall in love with Jesus. And that falling in love, of course, is erotic overtones and is not something that men are comfortable with, you know, for good reason. It sounds homosexual. And that the language they used, which is the quasi-traditional language of Western Christianity, was very erotic and for many men has homosexual overtones. And also the churches they brought men into were of course predominantly female, and the women, when the men came, they found this predominantly female environment. Also, I understand they really did not reach totally unchurched men. They Promise Keepers, almost like the revivals in the 19th century, almost always reached men who had some connection with the church through a mother or wife or girlfriend or a sister, something like that. That the really unchurched men who had no connection with the church have been untouched both by the revivals and by the current revival Promise Keepers.
You also quote from a regular guest here on Issues Etc., Frederica Matthews Green, who's a columnist, and she... this is a quote you have. Frederica Matthews Green reports that there is a genre of Christian rock that Christianizes love songs by substituting the name of Jesus for the girlfriend. Does that go along with what you've been talking about?
Oh, very much so. Again, this is... in fact, Frederica noticed this, and other callers and shows I've been on have noticed this, that many of the songs sung in churches, popular songs, are in fact love songs. You substitute, you know, Jesus for the boyfriend. And this, unfortunately, has roots in the an older hymns, the famous hymn by John Wesley, Jesus, Lover of My Soul, which is sort of an odd way to speak about Jesus. And so this erotic attitude toward Jesus, again, has roots go back centuries.
Was another shortcoming of the Promise Keepers, to stay with them for a moment, was the emphasis on kind of the essence of religious expression being emotional?
Well, men are emotional, of course. You ever been to a football game, you'll notice a certain amount of emotion going on there. So it's not a question of emotion. It's men can be emotional about and excited about things. It's a question of the displays of emotion that a particular culture find comfortable. Obviously, an Englishman and an Italian express them, you know, and even in Europe express themselves differently. But I don't think that's the problem. I think it's not the emotion. It's the type of emotion. The type of emotion they were asking people to express was sometimes this quasi-erotic devotion toward Jesus, which men, once they start feeling, if they're normal men, feel very comfortable with.
So, in other words, there are certain genres of music and things like that, expressions in the culture, that are inextricably connected to a way a man would express affection, erotic love for a woman, and the church has ill-advisedly attempted to simply substitute Jesus for the woman.
Basically, that's it. That this women may feel comfortable singing these songs, but men feel very uncomfortable singing them.
Now, let's talk a bit about the time of the Reformation. Was there an attempt to redirect the feminization of the church that was already well underway at the time of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation?
Yes, there was. The in some ways, explicitly, especially Luther, was trying to return to an older, more military model of Christianity. He knew that the oldest, the early fathers of the church, which he knew quite well, often spoke of Christianity as a warfare against the devil. And, of course, there are all the famous stories about him fighting the devil. And these are not just pious stories, but they express something really important in Luther, that he saw Christianity not as an erotic love story, which tended to dominate the Middle Ages, but as a warfare against Satan, in which we follow Christ our leader in this warfare, and fought and died with him, and that he wanted Christians to think of themselves as co-warriors with Christ against evil, and not as erotic lovers of a beautiful Christ.
You have also pointed out several times in conversations we've had before, Dr. Pottles, that part of the problem today, as in the past, is, as you say in your article in Touchstone, all too many pastors are not real men. And you tell a story about a candidate for ordination in the Presbyterian Church. Tell us that story, and what do you mean by this?
I have to refresh my memory.
Well, you're talking about a young man entering the seminary. He takes a battery of psychological tests, and the person administering the test asks him, "Are you a homosexual?" And he says, "No, I'm not. Why do you ask?" And the psychiatrist replied, "Well, you have the psychological profile of a homosexual, but don't worry, all successful ministers in your denomination have this profile."
Ah, that's true. And what was going on there is not, he was detecting not homosexuality, but a feminized personality. Now, I'm not extremely interested in, say, football. I like outdoor activities, but I'm sort of a loner. So I would probably come out not on the extreme end of masculinity in the psychological profile, because I don't like football, I don't like violence, contact sports, things like that. I prefer hiking and swimming. And then, of course, there are men who don't like any of this stuff, who prefer just to sit in their study and read. And they're scholarly types. But this sort of personality tends to match the personality of women, which is why ministers and women get along so well, because they have this similar personalities. But of course, homosexuals also have this personality, that the most homosexuals, not all of them, they're the biker types, but a lot of homosexuals have a very feminized personality. They're uncomfortable with being men. They like to associate with women. They like to do feminine things. They like to be hairdressers. They like to be interior decorators. and their personality has a similar profile to that of women and of ministers. And of course, when most men feel this, they may not articulate it, and they feel this personality in their minister, who may be perfectly heterosexual and perfectly normal sexually, they are uncomfortable. They say, "I really don't want to be like that. I want to be like, you know, a strong man. I don't want to be like a weak man or a feminized man."
Finally, you write, "Initiation into the mysteries of religion should be a part of becoming a man, not something that leads men away from masculinity." What are you picturing there?
Okay. For centuries, Christian men have been told, sometimes explicitly, to be a good Christian, you have to be less of a man. That the more you are of a masculine man, the worse a Christian you are. You know, if you're violent and aggressive and all these things, that you're not a good Christian. You can't be a good Christian. You have to give all these up. You have to become like a woman to be a good Christian. But of course, that's not true. That we are engaged in spiritual warfare, that men's aggression was given to them and should be used for the proper purpose. It's a gift of God. It can be distorted like any gift, but man's aggression is to be used to combat evil, to protect society, protect especially his wife and children, and to fight evil, both the physical evil of material enemies and the spiritual evil of our of the devil, and that man's aggression is a good thing if it's properly directed. And these masculine qualities are gifts of God, which have to be properly used. Men have to learn to use them properly, and then they will discover why these gifts were given them. Why do men have these tendencies? Why do men get angry? Why are these things? It's a purpose. It's not an evil thing. God has given these qualities to men for His purposes. And when men are shown what the ultimate purpose of these gifts are, they will realize, to be a real man, to be a, in the fullest sense, I've got to be a Christian.
Dr. Pottles, finally, with only a minute here before we go, what one piece of advice, perhaps two, would you give to fathers who desire that their children remain in the Christian faith?
Two things. Go to church with your children and especially pray with your children. If it makes an enormous difference if children see their father leading the family in prayer. I do it every night in prayers. I read the Bible and lead my family in prayers, and I think that's probably the most important thing you can do. Also, families who pray together stay together. I think the divorce rate among families who actually pray parents pray together is less than 1%.
Dr. Leon Pottles, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Okay, thank you very much.
Dr. Leon Pottles is senior editor of Touchstone Magazine. He's written an article there in a recent edition called Missing Fathers of the Church, and he's also author of the book The Church Impotent, The Feminization of Christianity. You can purchase this book, by the way, by calling Spence Publishing. They have a toll-free number, 1-888-SPEN-PUB, 1-888-SPEN-PUB, S-P-E-N-P-U-B, or you can check out the website for Spence Publishing at SpencePublishing.com, SpencePublishing.com. Mention Issues Etc., by the way, and you'll get a 40% discount on The Church Impotent by Dr. Leon Pottles. The toll-free number, 1-888-SPENPUB, SpenPub, or SpencePublishing.com. You know, it only stands to reason that a child who sees his father, girl or boy, a child who sees his or her father engaged in those things that Christians do, confessing one's sin, hearing the preaching of God's word, receiving the sacrament, bended knees in prayer, giving liberally to the church and to others, serving God in the daily vocation, a child who sees this will see that this is what a true man, a true father, is. Dr. Pottles is right. For too long, the church has said that all of these things that are quintessentially Christian, are things that men don't do. That in order to do these things, men must be less of men and more of women. And so we've compounded a problem over the course of generations. Less and less men, more and more women. The church needs not just a few good men, but fathers who show their children by going to church, by doing the things that Christians do, as men, that this is what fathers do, and in fact, this is what women do too. That God has created the distinction between the two for that very purpose, that fathers might be those who show their sons and their daughters what a Christian life is really like. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.